Yippee-ki-yay, motherfucker.
Wise men say forgiveness is divine, but never pay full price for late pizza. Cause you're a freak with a microphone.
Uh-huh.
I am an FBI agent.
You're listening to the Super Podcast, featuring hosts Super Marcy.
And I think everybody these days can relate to Serial Mom.
And Feed the Terrible Aussie.
But one of my pet peeves in movies, like people sitting down to have dinner and they don't actually finish the dinner.
This podcast contains coarse language.
See, watching this, like, I just want to go and
adult themes.
But, like, this whole movie is just hinges on someone's ass.
And potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Visit supermarcy.com for more information. Now for our feature presentation.
Listen, sister, if I want your opinion, I'll beat it out of you.
By the way, his testicle retrieval operation went quite well.
White Russian. No ice. Hold the vodka. Hold the Kahlua.
Isn't this 4215 pussy way?
G'day everyone, this is B. Javide, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome to a very special audio commentary edition of the Super Podcast. Unfortunately, my regular co-host, Super Marcy, won't be able to join this episode of the show due to technical difficulties with her laptop, but hopefully once they're all sorted out, she will be back to join us very soon. So, however, though, I won't be alone on this episode of the show because I have two very special guests joining me for this one. One is a returning guest and one is a first-time guest. And first up, of course, is the co-host of the awesome podcast, Schlockenor. And that, of course, is Lindsay Wilkins. Hello, Lindsay, and welcome back to the show.
Oh, no, thank you for having me. No, this is very exciting. I actually haven't seen this movie for a while, so I might be just the dumbass giggling in the corner for a lot of it.
I mean, to be fair, I think we'll all be giggling a lot throughout the course of this film, because I won't ruin what the film we're doing today is, but I think everyone's going to be enjoying it. And also joining us today is a first-time guest, and he has appeared on multiple episodes of my solo show Bead vs. the Living Dead, on many of the spin-off shows and the main show as well, but he is also the host of his own podcast, Failure to Franchise, and that is Trevor Snyder. Hello, Trevor. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I wish this topic wasn't under such kind of sad circumstances, but also we're watching such a joyous movie that it kind of balances out, right? So it's always nice to pay tribute to someone with such fun and hilarity, I guess. So.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And for those out there, as you all know, one of our favorite actors, Val Kilmer, has recently passed away, at least at the time of this recording, a few weeks prior. So Val Kilmer is, of course, as an actor, had brought so many great roles throughout the years, from Tombstone to Batman Forever and Real Genius and Heat and so many others. He was a great actor who just always was amazing anytime he was on screen. So he's definitely someone who we're going to miss a lot. And for this episode, in paying tribute to him and his work, we're going to be doing an audio commentary for his very first film that he ever did, which he also was the lead of, which was the 1984 comedy Top Secret from the team behind The Airplane. So, but before we actually go into doing our audio commentary on the film itself, let's talk a little bit about Val Kilmer. Lindsay, what are your thoughts on the late, great Val Kilmer?
Well, there wasn't anyone else like him. We've had a few very sad deaths this year already that kind of hit me in the gut. Gene Hackman being one of them. But when Val Kilmer went, it was just like, oh, he was one of a kind. I mean, his first movie was a starring role and he's like the most charismatic person in the room. Like he could kind of almost fit in anywhere and do almost any kind of role, whether it be serious, whether it be funny, whether it be action, drama, comedy. Like he was the kind of guy who could do it all.
Oh, definitely. And Trev, your thoughts on the life and work of Val Kilmer?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I echo all that. It's interesting because on my other show, Failure to Franchise, where we look at failed movie franchise starters, we just recently, a couple months ago, did The Saint. So we got to talk about Val Kilmer in there. And we also done Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. So we've talked about Val a couple times in that show. And he's kind of like one of those artists where I hate to say it already, but it's kind of like you don't realize what you're missing until it's gone. You know, and I say that even before that, you know, his all the health problems he had in the later part of his life kind of took him away from acting. And that's where I started to realize, like, oh man, we were like kind of taking him for granted near the end there, you know, because he had his career had a little bit of a dip at the end where he was making more kind of, you know, DTV stuff and wasn't getting that as the high profile stuff. He was doing those strange experimental films with Francis Ford Coppola. And we talked on my show about how a lot of that seemed based off of, you know, we also, you have to, when you talk about Val Kilmer, you also have to talk about the behind the scenes stories about how sometimes he was difficult to work with and everything. And I certainly, as someone my age, I read a lot of film magazines that covered that, and I kind of fell into that, like, oh, he must just be like a jerk or whatever, you know. And then kind of learning it later, like, oh no, actually he's just a. And I really credit that documentary he made about himself, Val, which is fantastic, with helping to illuminate, like, oh no, he was. It's not that he's a jerk. He just like really cared. He really cared about his art, and that made him sometimes difficult, you know. And I just thought that documentary made me fall even more in love with him as a performer and a human being. And man, that cinematic goodbye we got to him in Top Gun Maverick was like so beautiful. And like, but yeah, his death did hit me because I really thought, as far as I knew, I thought he'd been doing pretty well, you know, and I thought we would have him around for like a little bit longer, if not in movies, at least, you know, kind of, you know, to do more maybe retrospective stuff and everything. But an awesome performer. I'm sure during the movie we'll talk more about certain memories, but all the movies you named, I mean, I grew up on, you know, Real Genius and you know, Heat and Batman Forever, a movie I defend to this day. I think he's a great Batman. So yeah, he rules.
Yeah, and also too, I would have with Val Kilmer, he even though he had the movie style looks, you could definitely tell he was more of a character actor in the
Yeah.
body of a, you know, a handsome leading man. Like we've seen a lot of different actors like that, but you could definitely tell, like, oh, he's someone who, when he goes into a role, no matter what role it was, he really dives into it. I don't want to use the term method acting, but you could tell, like, he always felt more comfortable in the skin of as a character actor rather than just as a leading man. Not to say he didn't embrace the leading man part, but you could definitely tell he wanted more, instead of like the bland lead roles, he wanted something that had a little bit more of an edge or something interesting about the character he would play.
Yeah, just building on what was said about Val, which is a really great documentary if you haven't seen it. He really did care about his art, but he was also a weirdo artist, and I say that in like the best way. It wasn't so I can see why he would have been, and it shows you why he was difficult on set, because he was asking questions and why are we doing this? And wouldn't it be best if we did that? Because he cared, but also because he was such an artist, I don't necessarily think he quite understood how he was relating to people on like a, especially with the crew who just want to get through their day, just want to get the shot, just want to get it done. And he's like really nailing into it. And he wasn't more comfortable as a character actor, but I think he saw himself as an artist, and he was. He was one of our great artists, but he actually took acting as a form of art, not a method, not a job. He actually saw it as a form of art form, and we got some of the greatest performances out of that. So, yeah.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah, and I
And
think going off of like what Bede said, I think maybe a part of his curse, right, was that he was cursed with these devastating good looks, which meant Hollywood just wanted to put him in that traditional leading man kind of role, which meant he ended up in a lot of movies that were maybe not the sort of movies where you're expected to really take your character seriously and ask really intense questions. You know, they're not, when you're on Island of Dr. Moreau, I don't think they're thinking you're going to, you know, be that in depth about it all. And so his like, but him always trying to find that in his performances and question those things, obviously. Maybe, you know, create an impasse sometimes, but obviously his work was always the better for it.
I'll definitely. And I think for my listeners out there, if you're interested in watching the documentary Val, which I did watch on the day of his passing as well for the first time, it is on Prime Video. So definitely seek it out there. I mean, it is a fantastic and emotional documentary, but it's also worth it to see Val Kilmer's fight with John Frankenheimer on the set of the Island of Dr. Moreau, because that
Oh,
was
yeah.
like amazing.
Or even just like Tony Scott yelling at him, just like, stop it. Get over here. He's not angry with him. He's just like, oh, come on, Val. No, it's It's great. It's yeah, it was one of a kind because of that. And I love the story that he wanted to do Heat. I think it was the same year as Batman, so he was meant to be the movie star. And his agents tried to talk him out of it because he wasn't going to be above the he's still on the poster, he's still on the kind of the title card, but he wasn't going to be the lead. And it's like, well, he said, well, I'm in the movie with Al Pacino and Robert De Niro. Like, this is just going to be fun. And I think that's how he treated it a lot. Like, he was going to be with the two greatest actors who always questioned what they do. And then we got Heat, so.
Yes, exactly. So, but we all know that it all started with this little movie that we're going to be doing an audio commentary today, which of course is Top Secret. So for all you out there who want to watch the movie along with us, all you need to do is find a copy of Top Secret. It is available everywhere on streaming services, physical media, and also there was a 4K release that came out recently. I'm going to start the film from the very start. So once I say play and then go, that's when you start the film. And then that way our audio commentary will be in sync with the film. So we might as well get straight to it. So, Lindsay, Trev, are you ready to see the greatness that is Val Kilmer in his debut performance in Top Secret?
Definitely.
Absolutely.
All righty, let's do this. Counting down in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1, go. Turn the volume down just a little tad. Now, I know, Trev, you and I talked about this movie on an episode of one of my other shows, Bede and Sam versus the Video Nasties. And you know what? On that show, you said that you felt like this film might actually be better than Airplane.
It's my brain tells me that Airplane is better, but my heart says Top Secret.
Yeah, because I think you were right, though, because at least with Airplane, as much as I do love that movie, do not get me wrong, I love that movie to bits. But I feel like Top Secret is the Zuckers and Abrahams at, I guess, at their most purest, because it is joke after joke after joke.
Yeah. And I think it's just, you know what it honestly might be? I think, like, for a lot, like, probably a lot of people of our generation, I saw Airplanes so many times as a kid. So it might also just be that, too, that at a certain point I kind of hit my saturation point with Airplane, you know? But Top Secret, I kind of found just a little bit later, and it wasn't on as often as Airplane was. So it felt like more of this, like, little the secret hidden treat where everyone was like, oh my God, if you see Airplane and Naked Gun, everyone knows those are great. And you always had to be kind of like, you felt like a little bit of a comedy hipster, like, yeah, but do you know about Top Secret? Like, that's the real stuff right there.
Well, that too, and you're absolutely right, because the first time I saw the film was when it played as a midday movie during the week here in Australia. So that was how I became aware of it. It's like, how have I not heard of this movie from the Zuckers and Abrahams and starring Val Kilmer in his first movie role? Like, that was just surprising to me.
Sorry, I'm already laughing at the joke. Yeah, no, it is joke after joke after joke. Like,
You
the whole
know,
thing with the German guy, like, you think he's gonna, like, get killed by the tunnel, and it just, like, crashes through and he just wipes himself off. I'm just like, yes, I'm
you
fine, gonna
know.
kill him. Yeah, it's just like, me and my partner were re recently rewatching Naked Gun, and I hadn't seen that movie since I was a kid, and all the jokes kept flooding back. So sometimes I get the jokes, which is which, and kind of confused, but no one does just throwing jokes at a wall quite like the Zuckers. Like, it's insane. You just watch this, and all of a sudden, just the absurdity of it is brilliant.
Oh, yeah. And I just noticed one joke that I'd never even noticed before until now is when that soldier giving the note to the general, he takes off his helmet and his, like, band is still around his
The chin
head.
strap, yeah, the chin
It's the greatest thing
strap.
ever.
That's the thing I was before you joined the call, Lindsay, I was saying to Beat, I was like, this is gonna be such a hard commentary because it's just joke after joke after joke, and you don't want to fall into the temptation of just pointing out every great joke. But man, it is like every couple seconds here, you're getting like an all-timer.
And also,
Yeah, I mean, there's a mixture of, like, the verbal play. Bringing back to Airport, my still favorite line is, did you have the fish or the chicken? Yes, I had the lasagna. Like, I just think that is, like, the funniest thing ever. So, it will be more the visual jokes on this commentary because I would just be like, oh my God, that one. Like, my favorite joke which will come up is when the train's leaving the station, but it's actually the platform that's moving and not the train. Like, I don't know. It's just, it's stuff like that.
And also the songs are fantastic in this movie.
They are, yeah. It's a good,
Yes.
it's a legitimately good and funny soundtrack. Like you
Oh,
can just
yeah.
listen to it and
Yeah.
enjoy, yeah.
And also, Val did all of his own singing, which makes it even better.
Oh, that's right. He's playing like a Elvis type guy who's actually going undercover. I
And
forgot. Yeah.
also too, like one of the things I love about this movie, it's like you don't exactly know when it is set because it's a mixture of almost World War II films, Elvis films, and a few other things. So it, but it does have a little 80s feel, but it feels like it's like a mixture of different time periods all at once.
Yeah, I always took it like it's supposed to be of the time. So it's supposed to be taking place in 1984, but it's almost like the assumption is going to Germany is just like going back in time, right? Going back to World War II. Yeah. That's what's kind of fascinating about this movie too, right? With Airplane, they had a blueprint, a very clear blueprint in that they just had that previously existing movie. The name escapes me right now, but they actually like bought that
0 hour or
screenplay.
something.
Zero, yeah. They like bought that screenplay and just went through it and added in jokes. So they had the bones there for them. And they said when it was time to make their second movie, I remember hearing them talk about how like they didn't know. They're just like, I don't know, but they kind of wanted to do something with World War II, but they also thought Elvis movies were funny, so they just decided to just like throw it all together. And they have since said they think that's why this movie didn't work as well. That's their opinion. They say like, well, it's maybe like a little more scattershot. It's not as good of a movie. But I think that's what I respond to. I'm guessing it's the case for you guys too, is that it feels more anarchic. It feels like a Looney Tunes because it's just all over the place. And that's what
Oh,
I
yeah.
kind of like as a comedy. Yeah.
I mean, the fact that four of his top songs in the
Skeet,
Billboard are
skeet,
all
skeet.
got skeet, skeet, skeet in the title.
Yeah. I need to get that Rolling Stone cover with him and the surfboard and the shotgun as like a poster.
And
He
also,
wouldn't end up
too.
on that magazines. I mean, Val Kilmer was that good looking, so
Oh,
it's.
yeah.
And also, too, like, it's one of those movies, like, it is literally joke after joke after joke. So even if a joke doesn't work, it's immediately followed 5 seconds later by another joke that works better.
That's the brilliance of it. Like one of my favorite. Well, it's actually not. It's the Naked Gun. I watching Naked Gun made me realize how much just people have just been pulling from that movie and certain jokes and everything like that. But nothing beats the opening for the original Naked Gun with the car. And I know it was based on a show, but that again, they're going back to a very specific blueprint. Oh, so they can kind of insert jokes. But the whole thing of the car, police car, road with the siren, and then it just goes into the most berserk circumstances, into the point where you're actually on a roller coaster, and that is never not like gut. Bustingly funny for me, and the movie hasn't even started yet.
Now, this is one of my favorite visual jokes, the painting he's doing on the train.
He still manages to get it like draw it properly too, even as fast as they're going.
God, he looks so young in this.
I mean, you can definitely see like why, at least very early in his career. Like, I mean, he is a very good-looking man.
Oh, he's one of those guys that's like almost like aggravatingly handsome, right? Where you see him and he's like, oh, I can't believe there's people on Earth that were like that lucky in the genetic lottery, you know?
Just everything kind of sits right on his face, the hair, and then he's just got like the personality on camera to back it up. Like it's kind of like. Above all, remember, we've got to play by their
rules. Martin, I can tell you. Like one of the only things I was kind of disappointed in the Val documentary was like how he just kind of like breezes over this movie really quickly. I think he just mentions it kind of in passing at one point, and I was kind of disappointed that he didn't see. I don't know if he was dismissive of it, just simply had nothing interesting to say. But I think it is pretty compelling and telling to say like his very first Hollywood movie was a lead role in from the filmmakers who had just made one of the most beloved comedies ever. Like that's a pretty good like that's a good calling card, to get plucked out and put into not only that, but like say like, hey, you're gonna be essentially be playing Elvis in this as well,
Which he's played Elvis twice. I know it's mostly cut out of True Romance, but yeah.
I also think too another because I in the documentary I think one of the reasons why he kind of was at least at the time was a bit dismissive of the role because he actually trained for 6 months to learn how to play the guitar. for the film.
Oh no, this is not the movie you do.
And then the Zuckers and Abrams were like, "Can you just, it's don't look like you're actually playing. Look like you have no, don't have any idea how to play, and we're just going to make it even more funnier." So I feel like, I think he felt like, oh, all that work for essentially nothing. But I think he more came around on this film as the years went on, because I do remember
the hell did you say to him?
talking to him about this film very briefly at a convention,
Oh,
like
cool.
13 years ago, because he came down here for of all the conventions, he was here for a mini Back to the Future convention, which Christopher Lloyd will also attended.
No, this is a yeah, Airport was like one of the biggest hits of like 1980, I think, or something when it came out. It was just, I mean, that movie plays,
Oh yeah. And it
and I know they're remaking
the Naked Gun,
Naked
yeah.
Gun, which the trailer actually now I'm kind of excited for because I was dreading it. I'm like,
Yeah.
this is not a comedy you remake. And the whole portrait scene, I'm like, okay, they get it. They know what kind
That's
of
what got me
humor.
too. That last joke, I was like, okay, I'm in. You can't,
Yeah.
you know.
They know what they're doing. Like they understand the humor that the kind of humor that they're actually playing around with, and the whole just him shaking his head, going, "Nope, not doing that."
And also too, like, it's funny to me because Airplane pretty much killed the disaster movie genre, since that was huge in the 70s, because since it successfully took the absolute piss out of it, then people were like, yeah, we're not gonna do disaster movies
Oh no, they
anymore.
tried. Like, what's his name? Definitely tried to make a few of them, but it just wasn't quite the same afterward. It's kind of like, how long did it take for James Mangold to make another music biopic after Walk Hard? So.
And also, in a way, you could see, because from what I gather with the new Naked Gun coming out, even though it's, well, kind of a remake slash sequel, because it does take place in the world of the previous Naked Gun films, but it also seems like it's also going to also satirize Liam Neeson's action movie work, because I think that's the perfect way to approach it as well. So don't be surprised, like Liam Neeson's going to be just doing comedies from now, because nobody's going to take his.
I'm
Sorry,
not
I'm
angry
just
at him.
laughing.
Sorry,
No,
I
I'm
just
not.
the whole
We've
Pac-Man joke just was genius.
made it through now, like what, 20 years of Liam Neeson just doing Taken type movies.
Yeah.
So I'm fine with him transitioning over to another genre for a while. And
Yeah.
he is very funny. You know, he's
Oh,
when he kind of concentrates on comedy, he's really funny. To me, there's like a lot. Not to, I mean, this is still in the spirit of this movie, but if like what there's a lot riding on Naked Gun for me, like the reboot, and just like I think it's the movie that you're holding a hopes on of just bringing back the parody film, like the spoof, you know,
yes.
which is like such a dead genre, killed by like Friedberg and Seltzer, you know, those guys who did like
Yeah.
Date Movie and Epic Movie. I know we're also getting a new scary movie like from the Wayans, so hopefully that will be like kind of a return to form as well. But
Yeah.
I love like the 80s and 90s were obviously, including this one, including Top Secret, were the glory days of that spoof film. And I think like what like again like Airplane used a script like a previously existing script. Airplane and Top Secret are using previously existing genres, but the key to these was the jokes were not all just like, hey, look, it's a character from a movie you know. You know, it's not like, oh, well, here's Iron Man talking to Willy Wonka, and that's what they all just became, unfortunately. But there's so much more cleverness in the joke construction here.
Yeah, one of my favorite movies is Young Frankenstein, which is a parody movie of the Universal Monster movies, which I only found out recently. The structure was taken from Son of Frankenstein, so I was definitely Leo pointing at the screen, going, "Holy shit, this is Young Frankenstein!" But yeah, again, that sort of plays with liking the genre, but kind of playing with the tropes, which this movie is absolutely doing and being silly with it. I love the fact that Omar Sharif is playing the spy. This is wonderful.
And the kind of not to toot my own horn, a couple years ago I interviewed Ian McNeice, who's on screen right now with Omar Sharif, and at a pre-convention kind of interviews with a whole bunch of celebrities. You can listen to it over on the Super Network right now. And literally, my very first question to him was about, "Can you tell us about the time working on Top Secret?" And he was
With
like,
Omar
"Oh,
Sharif.
I Oh yeah," and he was like, "Oh, I love that movie," and he was just talking a lot about his
Try this.
performance in this film, and talked about the whole dog poo thing and all that as well. So, the funny dog poo, I should say.
Imagine you're an actor of like the 70s and 80s and you get to work with Omar Sharif and it's in this scene. You know, like I mean, obviously I love it, but it's just so funny.
Well, I think that's also too, like, I think what Abrams and Zucker, like, they kind of make them so different from Mel Brooks. I love Mel Brooks, but I think they found what made their parodies work better is they cast actors who were not comedians or had comedy backgrounds in their roles, because this having dramatic actors in a comedy makes it more funnier.
Oh, I remember watching Creepshow once, and Dan, my partner, walked in, and he was looking at Liam Neeson in the most amazing cardigan sweater thing you've ever seen on screen. And he's like, "Oh, is this a comedy?" I went, "No, it's a horror movie." And he goes, "Why is Liam Neeson in this?" I'm like, "Ah, let me tell you about his career before the Airplane."
And also, let's not forget. Now I sort of realized someone pointed this out. Leslie Nielsen, Liam Neeson. Is that another reason why he was cast in that movie?
Well, it's also Seth, what's his name, of Family Guy, who has always been champion. Yeah, Seth MacFarlane. He's always championed Liam Neeson as comedian. Produced it. So, but the whole God Lollipop gag with the friggin' him killing, I'm just like, okay, I might be in on this movie. I thought I was going to hate it because you're right. Parody movies have fallen out of fashion because it was just a, hey, look at this pop culture reference without actually making a joke about it. And when you watch something like this, it's just joke after joke after joke. And it's no matter how that was a really cool transition.
That was a cool transition.
It was Zucker and Abrams. It's just literally just throwing things to the wall, see what sticks. But the thing is, they're such good at these very specific, I say dumb in the like as a compliment, like this dumb humor that just makes you smile. And it's not about trying to be uber clever, though these jokes are really clever, but it's just about look at Val walking like he's the coolest guy in the room. It's just about trying to make people laugh, and it's all kinds of humor. Like Mel Brooks had a very specific style of humor. These guys are just throwing everything at it to see what sticks.
And I love like they could take like a specific little thing that you know you don't really think of, and they build a joke around it. Like especially if you go into a fancy restaurant like here, it's like, oh, you need like at least a jacket to wear. And they literally, it's like he goes in the next room and he's literally being suited up and stitched together by a tailor, as we can see in the background, because that was also a thing I think the Zuckers and Abram did really well. Is like in the foreground, it's played straight, but in the background, there's always a joke going on.
I think the other thing they're really good at and like kind of masters at is knowing the important balance between comedy, but also having an actual like dramatic structure to someone. And this goes back to what you're saying about getting like real dramatic actors to come in. Is what's great is it's always fun to see dramatic actors come like want to have fun and be in these goofy comedies, but it's also great when they bring them in and say, hey, don't play up, don't be hammy, don't be cartoonish, right? Play it straight, and that's where the humor will come from. That's kind of like why, even though I love the Naked Gun movies, I kind of still mildly almost prefer Police Squad, because in that Leslie Nielsen is still playing Drebin very seriously, just like he plays the doctor very seriously in Airplane. I think that almost makes it funnier. You know, by the time you get to Naked Gun, he's now kind of hamming it up a bit. He's putting on the faces and everything. But I love when they're like leading men. Like Val does a good job with that in here too, is that I think he just plays it like the way Elvis would have played this part, and I think that sells the comedy really effectively.
And also even though he could do funny, if you watch Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, you're just reminded, oh yeah, Val Kilmer can like be one of the funniest people to ever exist. Like, just who taught you math? But here he is actually being the straight guy, and he is actually being the movie star. He is being Elvis, and all this chaos is just happening around him, all this stupidity, and it just works so well.
Oh yeah,
it's really like admirable. It's kind of like it's a testament to like lack of ego. I mean, like, you know, especially for his first performance, maybe that's why. But I mean, it's like, when you get cast in a comedy, obviously the inclination I'm sure is I hope I'm funny. And I think it's very like smart to realize like, I don't always have to be funny. Everything that's going on around me is funny. I will be remembered as being in a funny movie. I can just play this straight, and that's where the humor will come from. And I don't think every actor is willing to do that.
No, they always kind of want to be the bigger role where they get the big laughs, where they kind of get to go big. And it's sometimes the straight man or the straighter man that kind of does really well. Though I wouldn't call Val a straight man in this movie because I think he's generally really funny, but he's not as say big as like Omar Sharif. He is literally playing a spy character. He was, yeah, it's wonderful.
Excuse me.
And also, like, Val Kilmer, again, to go back when I just tooted my own horn tonight. When I did meet him, like, he was very funny, but when I met him the first time, he was, like, the first big major celebrity I ever met, and I was tongue-tied when I met him, because he saw my name when he was writing the autograph, and he said, that's an interesting name, where it comes from, and even though I knew exactly where it came from, my mind went blank, and I was like, I don't know. And he was like, you don't know your own name? I'm like, I do. And he said to me, it's like, oh, you know what Val is short for? And I said, oh, what's it short for? He said, it's short for Valiant, with just the big smile on his face when he said that. So, but also, like, his interview, like, in the big kind of Q&A and all that, he was very funny. He did a lot of, like, Marlon Brando impressions, like, dead-on Marlon Brando impersonations.
Yeah, I actually know one of the accountants who worked on Island of Dr. Moreau. And it kind of, the story is the way he tells it, especially because he was writing the checks for a lot of what was sort of happening. He wasn't on set. It felt like Val Kilmer was trying to match Marlon Brando kind of thing for thing. So... Yeah. Obviously, when you're one of the greatest actors, also one of maybe the most difficult actors of all time, I think he was trying to match it. So Marlon Brando threw this absolute massive party at the end of shoot just to sort of say, hey, I think it was his way of going, yeah, I know you put up with a lot, but I'm Marlon Brando, so I'm going to throw a massive party for you. And then Val Kilmer did the exact same thing a few nights later, threw this massive party. So it felt like, I don't know if it was a competition, but it just felt like Val was trying to match Marlon beat for beat.
Oh yeah. Week in Philadelphia?
Maybe so. Though that set just sounded chaotic.
Yes. Yes, Trump.
I have to ask you, when you met Val, did you have him sign an 8x10? And if so, which movie, like, did you have him, like, sign a picture for?
Honestly, no. I've got him to sign my photo with him.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
I actually posted it up on the day when he passed away. I posted it up on my Facebook page. And I should have got, like, one of his actual pictures. I'd never gone to a convention before, so I didn't know, like, what you could do. And I just thought, I'll just give him the picture that he and I took together, and he just signed it for me, so.
It's always a fun game I like to play when you go to a convention and you decide to meet someone, if they have, like, a huge kind of filmography of, like, what do you choose for them to, you know. And Val would be a tough one for me of, like...
Yeah, who would you... What poster would you bring to Val if you ever got the chance to...
Yeah, it's, I'm sure, you know, he was actually, Val Kilmer was at a Comic-Con I went to, but he was very expensive and his line was very, very long. And I didn't do it. It's one of those things now I'll kick myself for forever. He had actually brought along his own, like, custom made Doc Holliday pop vinyls, like Funko Pops that he was selling. Ooh. And that's probably, I mean, it'd probably be Doc Holliday I'd probably have him sign, because I think that's his best role. But there'd also be a part of me that'd be really, really tempted to have him sign either, like, you know, a Top Secret poster or a Kiss Kiss Bang Bang, because I love both of those as well.
I might have to go Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. I generally love him so much in that movie. I think he just gives that movie so much heart, even if he is just so fed up with everyone in that movie.
Already two great jokes.
This character's fed up. Like,
yeah. Two great jokes. It's like, Nick, where did that come from? Oh, my dad thought of it while he was shaving. That's a good one. And also, of course, the classic, like, oh, I know a little German. He's sitting right over there.
This movie's production design is actually kind of wonderful. It generally is leaning to that 1940s aesthetic of looking like a movie set. Like, it looks like Casablanca in a lot of ways. It's...
Mm.
That always helps comedy too, right? When it looks like a real movie. I think that's something we also got lost in, those, like, bad 2000s spoof movies.
Oh, yes.
They all just look so cheap and digital. And, like, no, it's like, this is funnier because it's, you said there was a good transition. Like, the filmmaking is actually on point here. The sets and costumes are great. It's full of handsome people and real actors, you know? So you're more willing to, like, give yourself over to the insanity when everything else about it, your mind is like, oh no, this is a movie. It's not just some, like, dumb joke, you know?
Yeah, I remember. I can't remember which one it was, but they were doing, like, in. It was referencing 300, so it had the Persian War.
Oh, yeah, Meet the Spartans.
The Spartans, and that's the only thing. I was on TV. I watched, like, 2 seconds of it, and it was literally no jokes. It was just literally referencing that, and there was, like, it was just like, okay, I'm I'm not doing these anymore. So to watch this and go, yeah, this looks like a real movie. It has real sets. It's referencing film history in a way. Like, it's not accurate at all, but it's kind of referencing what you think a World War II movie would look like and mixing in the Elvis with it. And it's just, yeah, they were really good filmmakers. One of them is still, well, I think only, well, one of them created CSI, so he's like fine. But it's, yeah, it's this kind of, it's just a,
I like how we all
sorry, I'm
just
getting, I'm getting
stopped it.
distracted.
Get it? I was
Val
just saying,
singing.
like, yeah, well, it's like we all got this literally stopped as Val started singing in this movie.
Great dancer too. I mean, look
He
at this.
is.
The whole package, yeah.
Yeah, like you could definitely tell, like he really wanted to make sure he was channeling Elvis in this movie.
He's taking it seriously. So it's, yeah.
Yeah, I think one of the Zuckers kind of fell down like into like the right wing like pipeline a little bit too, because I know he made like he made that like Michael Moore parody movie, which was pretty unwatchable. And yeah,
Yeah, that was
but
David Zucker, I believe.
okay, yeah. There's a really great, I don't know if you either of you have read it. I would really recommend it. It came out, I think, last year. A really great oral history on Airplane that came out like a book all about the making of Airplane, and kind of also covers obviously the Kentucky Fried Theater days all the way up through Airplane, and it's really really good.
Yeah, I'll have to check that out for sure.
I
And
really
it's
wish
kind
they
of
would do one for this, but I know this movie doesn't have quite the beloved, you know, like it's not Airplane, unfortunately, but I would definitely like buy
I think you
a history of
could. I mean,
yeah.
the kind I reckon it will be after Naked Gun and Police Squad, because I think that just has a much rich text history of because Leslie Nielsen is so beloved now, and just the history of that franchise. But no, this deserves it as well, because it's just it sounds so condescending, but it's a real movie. Like, as much as I love Police Squad, it is just literally a function to show jokes. Like, it's nothing
Well, and
more than
it's
that, which is great because I giggle every single time, and yeah.
this is the and Top Secret's reputation has grown too, right? So like
Yeah.
when we were young, like this movie was like a little harder to find, and you like only the cool people knew about it. But you know, I think when Bede, you said like how Val Kilmer's opinion on that has come around, I think it's probably because he's seen like it get the cult of this movie grow much larger, you know, to the point where, like you said, they're putting out a 4K of it now. I think it's definitely found its audience. It just took a little time.
And also now with, you know, Val's passing, I can imagine this movie will reputation will grow even more, because people will go and seek it out, knowing that it was his very first film.
These guys had the nerve to meet Omar Sharif and ask him to do this, you know? And
Yeah,
Omar Sharif said yes. That's the great thing.
this is the brilliance of it. Yeah, you're the guy who was in Lawrence of Arabia, and you get him to do this, and it's like the greatest thing in the world. It's just, yeah.
But I could imagine, like, Omar Sharif, at least at the time, wasn't offered comedies as big and as broad as this. So you could definitely tell it's like, oh, I'm going into this 110%.
Well, yeah, and that's the thing. It's like, this is why people have to remember about actors, with the rare exceptions, right? With the, I mean, there are like the super, super serious actors who kind of like fit into the cliche of it a little bit, like the Daniel Day-Lewis's. But in general, actors are humans too, and they probably all want to have fun sometimes. You know, people often ask me, why do I actually enjoy like the underworld movies? And I'm like, you got like in those movies, you got like Derek Jacobi, you got like Bill Nye, you got like all these like real like
Mountain Sheen.
Charles Dance, like showing up to play vampires and werewolves. And it's like, of course they want to. They grew up like watching the same dumb monster movies we did, and they want to play and have fun too. You know, and so I'm like,
Chris
that's
Nolan Love is a Fast and Furious guy, so yeah.
Oh, there you go. Sexual innuendo going
There.
on
Yeah.
there. By
It is a Zucker
the
Abrams movie, by the way, so yes.
way. Yeah. Also, don't blame him. When I first saw this movie as a kid, I definitely had a pretty big crush on Lucy Gutteridge as Hillary in this.
Oh yeah. Like, it's funny though, it's like I know her through this film, but I don't think I've ever seen her in anything else. I know she's been in other stuff, but it's like
Yeah, she never became like a huge star or anything. But, well, speaking of sexual innuendo.
I mean, I mean, again, like, I mean, that opera patron has an idea getting the binoculars out. And again, it's like those subtle things, like everyone knows that a lot of male ballet dancers most of the time have pretty big bulges. And it's just like, let's exaggerate that even more.
They're wearing cod pieces, B.
Yes. Yes.
Not just sports people. Ballet dancers have to protect things. So that's why it seems so big. It's because they're actually wearing cod pieces. Like, I recently found out in Labyrinth that David Bowie was wearing a cod piece, and my whole childhood just was like, because I had a very specific image of David Bowie on my head. I'm like, oh, okay. Probably way too young to have it, but it's there and you're staring at it. But yeah, it's a great joke.
Just like to throw in a zoom in there, just in case if you don't see it.
Because I didn't see it. I thought it was hands, but no.
This is a great joke here too. Like the face manhandling joke is something I always remember.
Yes.
Think about.
Again, it's the simplest jokes that always end up being the funniest.
You think we better wait for the police?
That was the police.
Again, what's going on there?
No, it's just these little sight gags that they do that. like that one. That don't actually mean anything, but they're just like a surprise that, like, back in the movie before when you had all the kids with the surfboards running toward, but you just had these elderly people with guns running toward the water. It's just like, it doesn't mean anything, but it's just a really great sight gag.
Sorry. See all the mice just running around the.
Sorry, I just saw that.
And I love that they just walked in a room where there's just propellers everywhere and fans around the entire room.
The prop room, yeah.
The prop room,
when
yes.
When we get to it, there's a few in here that are contenders, but I just remembered there is a joke in this movie that is maybe one of my like top three favorite jokes in any movie of all time. So I would definitely point that out when it comes up. But honestly, I mean, really, you like anybody could say that for like almost any joke in this, and I'd be like, yeah, I get it, I understand, because they're just like nailing it out of the park here. Mm. But,
this joke in particular, I love. Again, the cliche of like, oh, how many days I've been in jail, scribble it down. And then to ruin the joke for everyone, like, now it's like, oh, finally you turned up. I've been here for 20 minutes.
Yes.
Nick, I've tried everything.
Oh, he's even wearing like a Elvis type prison uniform. That's great.
Yes.
So I want to ask the two of you, because it's relevant, because I was reading again about why Zucker and Abrams felt that this movie didn't do as well as they were hoping and wasn't as big as Airplane. And they said that they thought one of the problems was that people held Airplane 2 against them, even though they had nothing to do with it. So people were like, well, I don't know. Airplane 2 wasn't as good. But I want to ask, because how do you guys feel about Airplane 2? Because I'm actually I'm a pretty big Airplane 2 fan. I've always like, I know Abrams and Zucker have said they've never even watched it, but I understand why they're upset that they just went ahead and made a sequel without them. But I actually quite like Airplane 2.
I mean, it's been ages since I've seen Airplane 2, and I remember being a bit on it. I apologize. I am just more terrified of this anal intruder thing that his boss has. I'm surprised a joke like this, and mind you, I don't know if this movie was rated PG-13 or anything when it came out, but it's like, if this was a PG movie, I'm like, damn, they got a joke like that in a movie that, but then again, it was a bit more of a lenient time with
yeah, it was.
Like,
we were
this.
Pretty loosey-goosey back then.
Yeah. But Lindsay, your thoughts on Airplane 2? Lindsay, I think you're frozen. Don't worry, she'll come back with when she's unfrozen.
Yeah.
Again, another joke I love, just having the priest guiding the prisoner down the Green Mile, and you think it's Nick who's going to be electrified, but it ends up being the priest.
Sorry, I was laughing so hard at the anal intruder joke, I pulled out a cord and then lost connection.
And now that priest is dead. But I was about to say, Lizzie, what are your thoughts on Airplane 2?
What, Airplane 2? Yes. I can't remember it. I haven't seen it since it... Well, it's not quite since it came out. I've only seen it the one time.
I would say revisit it. In particular, the last half hour, everything William Shatner does in that movie is so good. Like, he is like the saving grace that comes in and just like destroys at the end of that movie.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's kind of one of those things where I'm like, yeah, like Speed. I should watch the sequel and see, like, give it a chance. I'm like, yeah, but I could watch Speed or I could just watch Airplane again. And just the way that Lloyd Bridges just keeps ramping up with the, this was a bad day to quit amphetamines. And it just, yeah, it's just too perfect.
Strangely, that's I was going to say, like, strangely, that's a line I quote a lot. It's like, uh-huh. Yes, tell me if his condition changes. He's dead.
I should actually revisit the original Airplane because it has been a long time. Because, like I said, it was one of those movies where I probably watched that movie in the hundreds of times when I was younger. And you just got to a point where it was so burned in your brain, you felt like you never needed to watch it again. But now it's probably been over a decade since I've watched it. It might be fun to kind of go back and see if I have forgotten anything or if it's as memorized as I think.
Every time I'm delighted, it's the guy in the background with Lloyd Bridges' office, and he's just like a grinning idiot. And like, he's like maniacal. Yeah. I don't know what he's doing. Yeah, he's great. Like, he's the funniest thing in the movie. And that's saying a lot, because that movie's hilarious. 2 hours just to get the smile off his face.
Perhaps the American has chosen to reconsider.
I just keep reminded, because like the other day I was watching a clip from leave no marks. Hot Shots Part Deux.
Oh, I love that movie. That's the one I've seen multiple times that I need to go back and revisit it.
Yeah. I mean, the first one is good. I really like the first one, but I've always been more partial to the sequel.
Yeah.
But it has a great joke similar to this one where Richard Kenner spits at one of the bad guys and it just like a little bucket of water hits him.
Do you know which room the final chemistry exam is in?
All the exams are over. Haven't you been to class?
No. No, I haven't studied. Oh, no. Yeah. I can't believe I'm back in school.
Hey, you know what? There's a bright side to everything.
Yeah.
Thank God.
Her man going to work.
Oh, this thing with this joke with the boots is great, too. I mean, like, I could just keep saying, oh, this joke's great, this joke's great. Yeah, obviously, but... I forgot. Again, when you see a joke and you just remember it suddenly pop in your head, I'd forgotten about this bit with the boots.
Yeah, again, it's just like the simplest of jokes, too.
Yeah.
And I think that's another thing that I guess a lot of parody films, or especially during that period, is like some of the best jokes aren't the big, extravagant ones. It's like the tiny little ones that work best.
It was really sad to watch that genre like die off because, when I was a kid... I mean, this was like one of the biggest subgenres in comedy, and we were getting like a lot of really good and even like the minor ones back then were like pretty decent, right? I'm trying to remember the name of like what was the name of the Basic Instinct one with Armand Desante?
Fatal Instinct.
Fatal Instinct, like that's pretty decent, you know, for like a little minor, or like National Lampoon's Loaded Weapon 1. Like
that's the one I was thinking of. Like, yes.
Yeah,
that's an underrated classic. That one.
Yeah.
I remember even seeing. One that I really loved growing up was, The Silence of the Hams. I don't know if either of you two have seen
I have. I remember movie. Loving that one, even though it has my beloved Dom DeLuise, I'm pretty sure, playing. Or is that another one where he plays Hannibal Lecter?
I think
it is that one, yeah.
Yeah, and also F. Murray Abraham also played a Hannibal Lecter type character in Loaded Weapon 1 as well.
Yes, yeah.
No, it was kind of cool because you kind of realized with these movies, you realize kind of what big moments were really kind of capturing everything. Like Silence of the Lambs was parodied everywhere. The Matrix was parodied everywhere. And we don't necessarily get that a lot anymore because we just don't have parody comedies. We don't have that shared experience of like, oh yeah, this is a thing that burned into my memory. Not the actual thing, but the parody of it.
Here we have Batman and Alfred together.
Yeah, I was
looking at the cast before and going, what the hell?
dimensions of the. I wonder if Michael got and Val Kilmer when they worked on Batman Forever. Like, remember that time when we worked together on Top Secret?
I was like, good to see you again. Yes.
Yeah. This is actually the joke. The joke I was talking about, that's one of my favorite jokes of all time, is coming up very, very soon here. But not to get too highfalutin about it, but feeding off of what Lindsay just said, that was also when you were a kid. It was almost kind of like film education in a way to watch these parodies movies, because they kind of taught you like what the tropes were of movies and like what are like, you know, by drawing attention to them, by making fun of them. I think it actually helped me like learn a lot of like the cliches, the overdone cliches in movies and things, and like that you're kind of waiting to have it, you know. Oh, speaking of PG or PG-13.
Yeah, I was gonna say. Yeah, but also, too, like, it's another thing as well, like, this is something I've always had debates about with people, about parody films, like, the differences between parody and satire. Like, yeah. I've seen some people say something like, oh, Scream's a parody of the slasher genre. So, no, that it's a satire of
the slasher.
Yeah, it's not a parody. A parody, to me, is something more like this, where it's more exaggerated, more over the top. And just it is going for more jokes than anything. Yeah.
Oh, okay. Actually, I think the joke I was talking about, my favorite joke, is not in this scene. I thought it was, because it's in a later scene in this area though. Oh, that's great though. So.
That line there was like, what is it? Dead rats in a tampon factory.
Jeez. Even just that kind of like more surreal humor, even when a movie wasn't like a full on like spoof or parody, anytime a movie would like, or TV show would dip into that, I always really appreciated that time. I know, B, like you're doing like a movie challenge thing this year where you're watching movies people recommend it. Yeah. And the one I recommended to you is Hexed, which I don't think you've gotten around to yet, but then
I haven't yet, but it's definitely on the agenda.
And then I don't know if it made its way to Australia for you, but there was a great TV show called Sledgehammer in America. Like it was a Dirty Harry parody in the 80s. Yeah.
Wait, did that have? Oh shoot, he's like in Veep and in Succession quite a bit.
David Rashke.
Yes. I think I remember seeing that. I didn't realize that was a parody as a kid.
It's a very crazy one.
I love the.
My partner and I have been, which isn't really, it isn't a spoof or anything, but it kind of dips into it a bit. We've been watching DC Legends of Tomorrow, and so sometimes you'll just have an episode where. That just goes completely crazy. They're just either doing pop culture references or they're doing a type of genre. It's very Star Trek in that way, but they really lean into the stupidity of it all. And I do appreciate that about it. I'm like, oh yeah, I forgot I did actually really enjoy this show.
I love the fact that, just to kind of go on what Lucy Gutteridge's character Hillary said earlier, there's someone, a bunch of girls in the crowd have a poster that says, "Welcome, Nick." Rather than Nick.
I think my favorite style of comedy in general is comedy that is like a very heightened reality dipping into surrealism just for no reason. It goes through like kind of waves. We have waves where like that'll be very like in fashion, and then it kind of goes away for a while. And I'm always happy when it comes back. Like a recent movie, to me, one of the most underrated comedies the last few years, Barb and Star Go to Vista Del Mar, was a masterpiece of that. Yeah.
Yeah, my sort of style of like humor that I love, because you know, anyone who listens to this show will know, and I do this like in every podcast because I always make reference to it. I grew up on The Simpsons and parody films, so the style of humor in those type of that film, I mean that show, and also the parody films like of the 80s and 90s, is what I built my sense of humor around. And also, I do realize the older I get, the things that make me laugh the most is random humor, like things that just pop out of nowhere that you don't expect, and it just always gets a massive laugh out of me.
I've seen B just do whole entire Simpsons episodes.
Yes.
We went and saw 92 Dracula, and he just did the whole Simpsons Mr. Burns as Dracula segment, just like I thought it was going to stop after a while, and he just kept going through the whole entire episode.
why isn't it a little boy?
Yeah.
No, that's exactly what I mean. Like that, yeah, that kind of like random humor. My favorite kind of comedy is my favorite humor. What'll make me laugh more than anything is when a joke goes on too long. So, like, speaking of The Simpsons, I mean, the Sideshow Bob and the Rakes, like, that's right up my alley. And, like, if you ask me, like, what are your, like, 10 favorite SNL skits? Like, 8 of them are just ones that are built around a joke that just goes on longer than it should. Like, that, I always love that. But then, yeah, just beyond that, just, like, as you said, just entire, just nonsensical randomness is, like, always going to, like, make me laugh as well.
Yeah, that's another thing.
Like, I also grew up on The Simpsons, so that kind of humor I just find funny. And also it's the non, like, I'm still a person who still really loves Napoleon Dynamite because that movie just makes no sense at all. But then you'll just have these really weird moments that come out of nowhere. And Star and Barb is a really good example of that. That is just so surprising. Like the whole Jamie Doran song bit.
Yeah.
And Yee Yee on the bike, just like singing, hanging out, throwing the papers. It's just everything about that movie. Or even Fletch Confess has a bit of that in it as well. It's a very straight Fletch movie. And John Hamm is being absolutely wonderful. And then it will just have actually Barb and Star, Addie Munro, I think it is. Just coming in and just being completely berserk. Like all the people he's, John Hamm is Fletcher's being kind of the straight guy to, with these insane lunatics. And that's the kind of humor I really, really, yeah, that's the one I respond to. It's like this, it looks and feels with an actual plot in an actual movie, but then it's like just these weird things are just throwing off in the corners, and they don't need to make sense at all.
So even that joke is like random. It's like they're shooing the bikes, like their horses. Yes. And also the carrier pigeon has a little helmet on.
Oh, it's so cute! Look at that. It's adorable. Adorable and funny.
Yes.
Stand in the eastern sector. I want the whole area sealed off.
Oh, jeez. I mean, it also kind of says, like, going back to The Simpsons, like, my all-time favorite Simpsons episode, and this is, again, probably where I base my entire humor on, is Marge versus the Monorail. Like, that's also...
Oh, that was just one of the greatest pieces of television comedy ever written.
Oh,
I
yeah.
Mean,
like,
yeah.
Even the makers of that are thinking, like, is this going a little too far with the humor? But it, too, is like this film where... Like, what I think of, it's like joke after joke after joke. And also, like, every time now again, it's like, oh, one of my favorite jokes from The Simpsons. And I realize a lot of them are from that episode.
Yeah.
Here's a scientist he can help. Is it Batman? No, it's not Batman. Batman's a scientist. It's just that little... I got the big
and
one,
of course,
buddy.
You know, like... That episode, obviously famously written by Conan O'Brien, and yes. Conan O'Brien himself. Also, I think a lot of my humor as a kid was just defined by staying up late and watching. You know, I was like, I also, my parents did get me into David Letterman when I was very young. So I had a little bit of that, like, David Letterman kind of, like, you know, classic anarchic comedy. But really, Conan was my guy. And if you ask me even today, who do I think are the two funniest, like, living human beings? I think it's Martin Short and Conan O'Brien. Those two guys are just they can do anything and I just start laughing.
Yeah,
but Conan O'Brien, like the nonsensical kind of sense of humor that was built on late night there was like, that's where my sense of humor was really formed as well.
Conan O'Brien crawling back into Demi Moore in that opening for the Oscars was so good. I was like, okay, and he's hosting again. So everyone's just gone, yes, can we just get him to do it again? Just the joke when he's going, is that the shoe? Who's the character that Martin Short plays where he's the interviewer? Martin Glick?
Jiminy Glick,
yes.
Yeah.
Some of the funniest, I mean, him interviewing Bill Hader is one of the funniest things ever, mainly because Hader just can't keep it together. Like, he is just sitting there, and often the people he's interviewing can't because he's insulting them to their face. And they just... Bill Hader's great because he just loses it from the first question. He can't keep it together for like a moment.
This is definitely the one.
Wait,
of the
is this
greatest...
Peter Cushing?
Yeah, it is.
Yes, it is.
And yeah, this is the one of the greatest sequences in comedy history.
Right. Yeah. There's two sequences in this movie that I think are like the two like most like the famous like classic sequences. This obviously being one of them. We'll get to the other one later, but. Because this is not only very funny, but it's also just one of the most like technically impressive sequences ever.
Yeah.
I love that there was randomly a book in the background just called Lesbian Bars.
Yeah.
And you're right. And of course, it makes fun of the Swedish language, because the Swedish language almost does sound like it's you're saying something backwards, which of course is poking fun at. But
do that in the movie Rumours, which is a really actually funny movie. It's just a brilliant takedown of Canada. But they do, that's how they play with the Swedish language as well. It's like, oh, she's talking gibberish. Oh, no, wait, she's talking Swedish. Oh, this is amazing. I completely forgot about this scene.
Have you guys ever seen this scene in reverse, where that you can see, like, played, like, in reverse, where you actually see, like, it in...
See how they filmed it? Yeah. I have not, yeah.
It's on YouTube, and I don't know if it was somebody who did it or if it was a special feature, but it is amazing how they did it. And also, another gag that never stops to make me laugh is, like, you hear a group of people talking about something that sounds sexual, but then it ends up not being sexual at all. It never fails to make me laugh. Don't worry about it. You said you were going to
tell me something about... Oh, that's just basically Austin Powers, but it is still very sexual, yeah.
But again, you can see where this type of humor would have influenced Mike Myers as well.
Oh, I was watching Naked Gun. I saw about six Mike Myers jokes. Like, it was just, oh, this is where I got it. There's a line of something working like 60% of the time, 100% of the time. And I'm like, wait, isn't that the joke from Anchorman? Did they just, they just literally lifted that joke from Naked Gun. And just like going, okay, so this is even though Naked Gun, I think, is more silly, I think it actually literally defined comedy for the next 30 years afterward.
And also
they just keep reusing the jokes. Oh, yeah, Blue Lagoon.
Yes. Because, you know, like, it's kind of funny, though. Like, it is making fun of stuff, but you did see stuff where it, like, poked fun at movies and stuff like that, or the absurdity of it.
This feels very Mel Brooks.
Yes.
Which is the comedy I grew up on. Like, I grew up on Airplane, but I never grew up on this. I saw this later. But I was very much The Simpsons and also Mel Brooks, who I think was actually trying to do a lot of, especially when you get to, like, Spaceballs, you can tell that he's trying to do more of what the Zuckers and Abrams are trying to do. Which doesn't quite work, though. I haven't seen Spaceballs in such a long time, so it'd be fascinating to go back.
Well, I'd say Spaceballs Spaceballs is arguably the last one he made that, like, really does mostly work. But, like, then you get into, like, Robin Hood is, like, more hit and miss, and then Dracula Dead and Loving It. By that point, I felt like, unfortunately, he'd, like, lost it a little bit.
Yeah. I was asked for Robin Hood just because I've seen it like 70,000 times. Like, I could almost, but it is very hit and miss. When it works, it's funny, but I think he's trying to do Abrams more a little bit, opposed to when he's doing Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, when he has his own sort of comic voice.
What it's like to be separated from your family at such a young age. Yeah, I mean, we were eating good back then, because it's like, you know, today, like I said, like, when, you know, all those, like, terrible, or most of those terrible spoof movies were made by those same two guys, but they never really became household names. But we had a period there where, like, you know, when people would talk about these kind of movies, there was, even as you were just alluding to, there was, like, the camps, right? You had, like, well, there's the Mel Brooks style, there's the Zucker Brothers style, and then, of course, you had still, like, Monty Python kind of looming large in people's minds as well, you know? And,
actually,
like, Grail and Life of Brian being great examples of spoof as well.
Oh, yeah, that's actually another one that also kind of morphed the my spoof. Comedy sense of humor is what was also Monty Python, because I used to watch the show a lot as a kid.
Yeah.
I didn't. I was always watching the stuff that the guys did after. Like, I was so much more in Fawlty Towers and all that kind of thing. And then we were traveling around somewhere and they said, oh, we're going to play Holy Grail. And I had already knew what Monty Python was, but I hadn't seen any of the movies. I think I actually fell off my chair laughing at points. Like, I think I finally got to the Holy Hand Grenade of Antioch and I was just under the table. Like, you just had to, like, lie down. I just, like, I can't actually physically stand up. I can't breathe.
Well, that has, I mentioned earlier how my kind of comedy is, like, the joke that just goes on for no reason.
Yes.
That my Holy Grail has a great example of that. The scene where the guard is watching Lancelot run up to the castle and they just keep cutting back to him and he's, like, never making any progress. And they just do it, like, three or four times. Yeah.
And it's kind of also funny how our humor changes as well, because I remember, even though I loved Monty Python as a kid, like the show, when I saw Holy Grail for the first time when I was about probably 12, I actually did not like it. But I think it was mainly due for the ending, because I felt it was anticlimactic. But of course, obviously, as I got older and more times I watched it, it's now, like, one of my top five favorite films of all time.
Yeah, weirdly, I think Life of Brian is almost too good to be really funny. Like, if that makes sense. Like, it's so good at what it's doing and so good at the spoof it's doing and just everything like that. I think certain moments are insanely good, but I think as a whole, it's a bit too good to be really funny. Like, you need some roughness around the edges. I mean, you can have, like, this movie, the amazing sequence with Peter Cushing and everything's going backwards. But, and this does feel like an actual, like, Val Kilmer's taking the singing seriously. Like, he's...
I kind of know what you mean, because, like, Life of Brian, as good as it is the Monty Python. Of the main three, it's the one I revisit the least.
Me too.
I really like Meaning of Life quite a bit.
I do too, as well.
I think the scattershot approach of that one, again, is actually works to its benefit, even though some people might be turned off by it.
Yeah. In a way, you could kind of see, like, Life of Brian being their airplane while Holy Grail is their top secret, in a way, since it's a bit more scattershot.
Yeah, I mean, this has an actual plot. It's moving
forward.
Well, what is a movie without a singing horse? Let's be honest. But no, it is. I mean, Airplane has a plot, but I think it's so jokey because you're just watching the people who are in the seats interacting and just making sort of silly jokes. And then this one actually has it's a proper spy movie, which is great. You've just got the lunacy on the sides, which is kind of why I think it's probably their best movie as a movie, if that makes sense. Even though
I was really surprised to see the Zuckers. And I mean, you know, it's always like, I think some people just take like failure or lack of large success personally, but to see them say that they thought like, well, this one didn't work because it's not as good of a movie as Airplane. Like, I kind of disagree, because I think what they see is scattershot, or what they see is like not a great structure. And I think this is maybe what you're alluding to, Lindsay, is like, I think this is actually the exact structure you would see in like a spy movie made in like the 50s or 60s.
Yeah.
It's like they're kind of actually nailing it. Yeah. Mm.
And also too, like with Airplane, since it is based on a book and another film, obviously they're just using that, and this is like pure them. It's also kind of like when people say, for example, that Jackie Brown is Quentin Tarantino's best film, but sometimes I think, well, it's not. Yeah, I can see that, but it's not a pure Tarantino film, since it is based on a book that he injected his personality to, but all of his other works are all purely him, and that is what I kind of respond to more than anything. If it's something like a very pure kind of creation from the filmmaker.
Because I don't think he could have handled that mature relationship between Max Cherry and Jackie if he didn't have an adaptation to kind of hang it on.
Mm.
He can now, like, I think, but back after
when he was that young.
No, not when he's that young. So I think that's absolutely true. I just love what he did with that material. I mean, that Max Cherry.
I'm really glad that Jackie Brown exists, because I think it's really cool that in his ultimate... Well, first of all, I do think it's dumb that he has this whole 10-movie thing. He needs to get over it.
It's so dumb.
Whatever. Yeah. When all is said and done, I like that we at least have one example of him adapting someone else. Just so you have there's also that. You know, it exists in there as
well. He's flexing that muscle. Yeah, but I just think the performances and what he did with that story is just... It's still one of my favorites. Mm. Even though I completely agree, it's not purely him, because all his other movies are so personal to where he is at that moment, when what he's interested in.
And it's so weird, like, because of now the whole 10 movie rule thing, like the script that was meant to be his last movie, he's now given off to David Fincher to direct to Netflix. And I'm not sure how I feel about that.
I thought it was an April Fool's joke. I didn't actually think it was real.
It's so funny. My story on that, I'll tell it really quickly so we can get back to Top Secret, but I think it's worth telling, is I was telling my wife about how I hate April Fool's Day on the internet because everyone does those dumb jokes trying to trick people. And I'm like, they're so stupid, you know? And I was like, and I actually said to her, I was like, you know what I really hate is when people do the ones that are entirely implausible. Like, it's one thing to try and trick people, but it's like when you have these like really implausible ones. And I was like, I saw one where they're like, oh, David Fincher is going to make a Once Upon a Time in Hollywood 2 for Netflix. I was like, that's so unbelievable. Why would they? And then I was like, oh, God. Then I found out the next day, oh, no, that was the real one.
That was the real one,
like, such an idiot, yeah.
It's going to be so weird. Like, I mean, the fact that...
I think my issue with it, my issue with it is that Fincher and Tarantino, as much as I like them both, they do not have similar tones.
No.
And I understand it's not going to be a sequel. It's just going to be another Cliff Booth movie. But even, I don't know, seeing Cliff Booth in a David Fincher toned movie feels very different than what we already have of that character. So it'll be odd, I think, for sure.
It'll be odd. It'll be interesting, because I think the way Quentin wrote Cliff Booth, I think he can exist out I don't know. The way he's talked about it, it sounds like this is the kind of his favorite characters, like his defining characters for both. So it'd be interesting to sort of see what someone else's take is on it. But yeah, I just learned that one. That's stupid. That's a stupid April Fools. Like, no, that's the real one. Oh, okay.
And also, we just witnessed the greatest break the fourth wall joke ever, which is, I think when I saw this scene for the first time and that happened, I literally fell over laughing. And I actually had done Val Kilmer's monologue entirely in one go to see if I could actually say it all without, you know, stumbling over words. And also, I've seen this joke in also in other movies as well. I mean, even Jay and Silent Bob Strikes Back uses the same joke as well, which is
I know, I still like
homage.
Spaceball's version of, well, it's not that, but I do like their breaking the fourth wall of them fast-forwarding the video. I thought was, I always liked that joke.
And it's Jim Carter from...
I was going to say, Jim Carter sighting.
From, what is it, Downton Abbey.
Can we just say from Willy Wonka?
Oh, yes.
He's, yeah. I don't know. I have a real thing against Bridgerton, and I don't know why.
This whole gang is great. Like, and this sequence coming up soon with, like, the shootout is just a series of, like, incredible gags. Incredible, like, visual gags and...
I think Chocolate Mousse is my favorite, like, of the gag.
He seems a good chap, really. I love Latrine. I love whenever Latrine shows up.
Yes. When I so desperately need you, and I love that it's just like all the names, like avant-garde, sacre, and croissant.
Deja vu. Yeah.
Yes. Have we met before, Monsieur? See, I'm just quoting this whole movie now. I floated at sea for days, nearly unconscious. And then, as luck
would have it, I was picked up by a passing freighter. Of course, I tried to get... I'm sorry, yeah, I know this thing, but my still favorite latrine joke is like, latrine, is that an old family name? No, it used to be called shit house. Good change. Good change. I am a Melbourne Mel Brooks girl, but yeah, that's just what I grew up on. Nigel. It's probably one of the... Well, that, except for Spielberg, because it's Spielberg. He was probably the first guys I'm like, oh, that directed Mel Brooks.
Yes.
Yeah.
And Latrine is just always injured all the time.
Yeah. You never had a chance. You know, he's the guy who's really out there. He's if we want to get serious for a moment, Latrine is really doing out there doing the work.
Yeah,
exactly.
Is.
Where's that coming from? The road.
Hey, come out! Yeah, this, I mean, from this point on, for like the next just couple few minutes here, just these so many jokes just burned into my brain. It's like incredible. You know, Tex Avery level visual Looney Tunes kind of jokes.
Oh yeah, obviously, like with the Zuckers and Abrams, you can see where they get there. I mean, I think a lot of these parody filmmakers, like Mel Brooks and the Zuckers and Abrams, definitely took a lot of inspiration from like Looney Tunes and all that as well.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. I mean.
Again, it's all the setup, and then...
You can't break that.
And of course, chocolate wheels. Why use a small gun when I could use a cannon?
This is the kind of Zucker Abrams joke I love, but it just keeps...
going and going.
It just keeps going and going and building and building, and it just how many times I can get a joke.
And of course, like, the dots and crosses. Yes,
the dots and crosses. It's kind of like, how many ways can we do this? It's like almost like a Marx Brothers joke, like a duck suit when they're in the actual in the fighting, get into the war. It's very
this
similar.
This is my favorite. The grenade joke here is one of the best bits.
Yes, and then everyone just still blows up anyway. So yeah. A part of me, like, obviously a lot of these gags are scripted, but I would imagine they would pick up more on the set while they're shooting this entire sequence.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Rendezvous at the cafe near the landing field. Yeah, because this is, like, way before, like, you know, I guess the more Judd Apatow style of improvisation, but I would imagine...
I'm glad we're away from that again. Bring back Barb and Star kind of comedy. I never could get into... It just go on... Yeah.
Like, I can definitely see
the
point.
It had its moment, but it burnt out very, very fast. Yeah.
Because I think people kind of realize, like, it can work, that improvisation can work. But as we kind of see, a lot of the movies would just go on way too longer than expected.
Oh, no. One of my favorite directors is Christopher Guest, and he is the king of improvisation, but he's also knew what to cut. So he would have these sort of moments and then they would cut. And I'm sure there's like 16 hours, even like days and days of footage from, say, something like A Mighty Wind or Best in Show, but they knew where to sort of cut it down to the best distilled moments. So you just have those, and those are the parts you grab onto. With a Judd Apatow movie, just, okay, we've been on this joke for like, which, yes, sometimes jokes get going for too long are great. But then you're just like, are we still sitting in a chair giving each other insults while playing video games? Like,
I think the sweet spot is, if you're going to do that that improvisational style, it needs to still be in service of an otherwise kind of high concept story, where you use it not as the crutch for the whole thing, but just as like an enhancement. Because if you get the right performers, it can still, like, to me, like, the sweet spot of that is, like, I love 21 Jump Street and 22 Jump Street. I think those are like masterpieces.
Oh, those are, yes.
And clearly there's a lot of improv in there, but also still they're dealing with these like kind of very, you know, big comedic concepts, and like kind of, you know, the more surreal jokes we're talking about, everything that works in there as well. The problem with Judd Apatow is he makes these like character-based comedies where there's no big gag to build to, so it's really like, well, I don't know, for the next 20 minutes we'll just have the characters riff, and that's where the kind of death of it is.
What I love about Christopher Guest, he does the same thing, so there's always sort of a concept, like Best in Show, like the character that Christopher Guest isn't actually making jokes, because he's playing a bloodhound, or a guy who owns a bloodhound. So he's kind of in service of that thing and what you would do. And then, of course, you have, Jennifer Coolidge steals that movie along with Jane Lynch, but their magazine, and just like, I'll have a half bottle, a thing of popcorn, half butter, half salt. It's just like chefs. You're right. They are the structure of an actual thing, and fitting into that with his Judd Apatow's, these hangout movies. And I don't always want to hang out with them.
Yeah, I guess that's also the thing. Like, yeah, Judd Apatow's comedies are definitely more character-based rather than plot-based.
Excuse me. Do you actually need a plot for comedy to really work? I mean, Simpsons always had a very... Well, the best Simpsons episodes had a very clear plot element of, say, Marge versus the monorail, or one of my favorites is the... what is the title? The Sideshow Bob one, when they go into the Cape Fear.
Yeah, Cape Fear is actually, Cape Fear.
It is called Cape Fear.
They've
got a very clear, distinct plot. Like, Sideshow Bob wants to kill Bart Simpson, so they have to do this. And then you can just kind of fit all the jokes sort of around it. And same with, say, a Christopher Guest movie or a Zachary and Abrams. Their best movies have a very distinct plot that they have to go for. And same with this movie. This works as an actual spy movie. So maybe even though you have some of the greatest characters coming out of comedy, maybe you do actually need like a very focused plot to kind of keep everything on track. And then you can just be absolutely stupid around the edges.
People have talked about this with horror as well, right? Where they say with the horror genre, I think it's true of comedy.
Yeah.
It's going to work best if you remove all the horror elements or the comedy elements and the story still works as a movie, right? It's still like an interesting, like, dramatic story, you know?
That's actually a good point. And I think when it comes to if you're doing a parody film, I always say the best type of ones either got to have a strong story, even if it's like a mixture of different plots from other movies, and also character arcs. Like, Nick has character arc in this film, and so does Hillary, you know? And if you can take out, and as you say, if you take out all the jokes, can the movie still work on its own as a straight film? If it can, then you know you've made a successful parody film. And again, Val Kilmer just going all in on these musical performances.
I love he didn't even have to, like, but it just makes the movie better.
Yes.
It's really kind of surprising watching this and then Real Genius next. And I'm sure some of this is on him as well, but it's surprising to me that he didn't become a bigger, like, comedic star earlier in his career. That those two movies didn't lead to, like, even more, like, you know, comic roles for him. He kind of segues right back into drama, where I'm guessing is where he probably wanted to be, but it's like, I'm disappointed that he didn't explore comedy more. He eventually found his way back to it, as we know, with MacGruber and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. But
Actually, I will say, an example of an amazing comedy that actually has a very loose plot to it, because it is literally a Looney Tunes cartoon is Hundreds of Beavers. Like that, I don't quite know. Yeah, that doesn't really have a plot, but the structures it's using actually are really well in place. Like Man in Wilderness gets pinecone stuck in foot, screams for 5 minutes. It's hilarious. Or they use the computer generated stuff, but that's a hangout movie that actually fits with a comedy, which is very.
Yeah. Hundreds of
Beavers. Come back a little bit. There are some amazing examples.
Yeah, I mean, Hundreds of Beavers is great, but my only problem with that movie is it needed to be a little bit shorter. Because it does get a bit repetitive at times, even though it is very funny.
Yeah.
And I love the fact that they did release a Nick Rivers album to coincide with the release of this film, which I want to kind of track down.
That feels like a very Mel Brooks joke.
Yes. You know what's funny though? Like, I was having a slight little bit of Mandela effect. I always keep thinking like there would be a Native American character jumping out of the play, but then I remember, oh no, that was in Hot Shots Part 2. Yeah.
There's something I wanted to say.
You don't have to say anything.
But I want to. You must know that.
Even that like simple joke of like him, her calling him back and his parachute just like return, like he goes up on the parachute.
And I sort
just
of
the guy with the duty free bag, I just think is just genius.
Yes. And also, like, I'm sort of thinking like their parachutes would be like all tangled up and everything if this was in real life, if they were that close.
But they would do that in a non-comedy movie as well if they're having like a heart-to-heart. Though the turnaround, maybe not. That's actually kind of genius.
So that like is the soap genius, opera.
I understand why they do it because they're trying to get both facial expressions. It's a good way of getting two front faces without. But the whole
and the fireplace has its own little parachute as well.
Oh, that's this is why these guys are geniuses.
That sort of cricket sound just takes me back because I was an extra in a zombie movie once. Oh, this is a great gag too. Wait for it. There we go.
That's very Abrams and Zucker. That's and great.
I was in an indie zombie film once as an extra, and I went to the premiere, and there was a scene where characters were talking around a campfire, and they used a cricket sound as an ambience. Sound, but the thing is, the cricket sound was so friggin' loud that it almost drowned out the dialogue, and everyone in the audience was like laughing and sniggering about it. So I'm like, it takes me sort of back to that. And also, there's a great little little model set for their plan.
I love that. It's actually really some good model work.
Exactly 7:25. We cut the power.
Oh my god! I'm just realizing who was the guy in Blue Lagoon? Shit.
Oh, Christopher Atkins.
Christopher Atkins
is now becoming like the resistance hero. That's that is just actually the funniest thing. If you know Blue Lagoon, you know everything's about Brooke Shields in that movie. And Christopher Atkins is just kind of like a coat hanger.
Yes.
Which.
Take the head. I'm taking the back.
Oh, I remember this. Okay. I always thought this was a Hot Shots joke, but apparently, unless they reused it.
All right. Be an asshole.
For a long time, when I was a kid, I feel like my memory is that the video box cover of Top Secret was always just the cow with boots on.
Yeah, it was.
He'll say, come. Okay.
You see, it's like the fake cow, and then, of course, you got the real one with gum boots.
I like how they use a real cow like they're hiding in,
and it's like the soldiers don't even notice like something odd about this cow that they didn't have before.
We've got to hurry. Can you see the gate?
Yes, it's just ahead.
Where are the guards?
I can only see one.
Ow! Yeah, there, girl. Move along.
I'll be right back in a second. Keep continuing. I should be back in
Sorry, it's just really hard because it's like, oh my God, this movie's actually really good.
Don't worry.
Funny because, like, you know, earlier I said that this has like one of my all-time favorite jokes, which we haven't even seen yet. I forgot how far in the movie it is. But then I'm like remembering this whole raid on the compound scene and I'm like thinking of like eight other jokes that are like amazing. I'm like, I'm just thinking like, are like my 10 favorite movie jokes of all time just all in Top Secret? Like, that's what it's feeling like as I'm watching this.
Yeah, especially when it's something you've seen a lot and you love, you just like, especially when it's a comedy, like you're like, oh, this part, like I'm the
worst. It's interesting
person.
Too, right? Because like comedy is one of the easiest genres to get sick of a movie after you've seen it a couple times and like not find it funny anymore. And I think like we've been talking about, like, you know, the masters, the Mel Brookses, the Zuckers, the Monty Pythons, they're really good at creating movies that are funny every time you watch them. And I think that's what's impressive.
That's the,
you don't get sick of the joke ever, and it's funny every time.
No, it's like that same way about I feel about Christopher Guest. Like, I think his movies have that quality as well, because even though they are very much hangout movies, and you generally love these characters, they are just generally the driest, funniest stuff. And it's always like a little line and you're like, oh, that was really great. And sometimes you miss it. And I think especially with the Zucker and Abrams, because there's so many jokes happening in the background and front and a line here and a line there. Yes, they have the big set pieces, but sorry, just saw the size of the clock watch. It's this kind of great, you kind of do miss things occasionally. So they do actually, it's like when you're watching a really great Marx Brothers movie, that they're constantly just putting little details in that you don't always pick up the first time you watch it. And then it just makes it for better repeat viewing because you're noticing these little details. So then, which they do as well. So.
Gus Svensson switching. Man, another great boot joke here.
Yes, this is a great joke. I love how this just turned into the Dirty Dozen all of a sudden. It's great.
Yeah, we're getting like multiple like genres in this one. Do like Elvis spy movie, Men on a Mission. Yeah.
It's like that movie trope of the Nazis taking over a European castle. Well, I love how he's the klutz. Jim Carter's like the klutz of the.
Yes.
This is great too. Like the joke coming up of like when the Nazi guard falls off the tower and what happens to him. That when I was younger, that to me was like the height of comedy. You know.
I mean, it still is in a way.
Yeah.
There we go. Here it comes.
Yep.
I mean, that's still a good gag.
Yes.
No, for me as a kid, the height of comedy was silly voices. And since I grew up with a lot of British humor, that was about 9/10 of what it was. I mean, Monty Python and Alo, which... It was all.
Got to throw in a wrestling joke in here as well.
It is 1984.
Yes.
Yeah.
Viva la France! And it's funny though, because like in Spy Hard, the Leslie Nielsen parody film, that also had a joke similar to this, but it actually had Hulk Hogan being tagged in and wrestling somebody. So sometimes humor, if a joke works, it can be recycled.
I don't know. My favorite spy thing, I think it is. Oh, I don't know if it's a satire or parody, but is it also Spy Hard with the Melissa McCartney?
No, that's Spy. Just regular.
That's Spy. I think that one takes the tropes of it, especially using the Jason Statham character as like this real serious hardcore spy, and then just have all this chaos happening around him.
Yeah,
I love the fact that they put boots on a cow. I don't know why.
The problem with that Spy Hard Hulk Hogan joke is we all know that the only, you know, the best usage of Hulk Hogan in a movie and the only allowable one is the Gremlins 2 bit.
Yes.
Yes. Everything else is a bit like, oh God, I'm looking at this guy.
Yeah.
Which I didn't even know that cameo existed until like I was older, because I was used to seeing that movie in the VHS form, which
the whole John Wayne version.
Wayne version.
Oh, this is the joke. Okay, this joke right here about the tunnel he's been digging. This is the joke I was talking about. This is one of my top favorite jokes in a movie ever.
Another day and I would have completed. I love Michael Goff.
Nice work.
Oh, Jane. Throws on the jacket. And you know for a fact that there was a bird in that yeah. tissue yeah. this entire time.
Very clever, my darling.
Actually, I've seen jokes like this where it would be like you'd see like a revelation of a character and it was like, what is all this about? And then it kind of clicks in.
Of course, he's the bad guy. I mean, just look at that hair.
Yeah. I mean, also, too, let's not forget, I mean, since the bad guys in this film are modeled on Nazis, I mean, he's the perfect candidate to be a Nazi because of his Aryan-looking hair.
Also, the fact that he's walking funny, I think, is still... It's like, this is almost as good as the prison rape joke in Dirty Work. Like, you know, the part of the pain and the humiliation... I can't remember the joke. Anyway, Dirty Work has, like, the greatest prison rape joke ever to put film.
This is my favourite gag.
Yeah.
The giant phone.
This movie does like playing with like foreground thing quite a bit.
Oh, yeah.
I think we talked about this joke on the podcast as well.
We did. See, there needs to be more foreground and background jokes in movies.
They really need to bring it up because it is a very actually vital part of filmmaking is the foreground versus the...
Nigel made me go back to the meeting.
I love the injection of the pillow.
Set off the alarm.
And what does he want us to do now?
Skull Nigel's a traitor.
Yeah.
That's also, I don't know what you call that joke. We just had with the pillow and just the gun now with the chocolate mousse as well. Like, I don't know. It always makes, you were talking about the kind of little things that always make you laugh, Bede. One for me is like when somebody just hands somebody, like something's handed to someone by like an unseen person off camera. Yeah. It always makes me laugh.
Is this a that specific too. Joke against the Pinto or is it?
It
just,
is. Yeah.
Okay. Yes. And also too, so
the Pinto was known for exploding in crashes. Yeah, it was a very unsafe car. Yeah.
See, if that joke was done today, it would be a Tesla.
It'd be a Tesla. Yeah, for sure. Yeah,
but I love the fact that
that's really the only that's kind of the only really dated joke that you kind of have to have been alive at that time to really understand like what they're making fun of. But
because they really displayed that Pinto bit, so I was like, going, do Pintos explode?
Yeah,
but even then, though, the Simpsons kind of did a joke similar to that in one of their Halloween episodes, where
the Gremlin,
the Gremlin just goes off the road, almost hits a tree, it stops just before it hits it, and it still explodes anyway.
Yeah, I think the Pinto was actually, if memory serves, the Pinto was like one of the cars was actually like Ralph Nader was like very instrumental in like kind of a campaign and crusade against it because they found it was designed in a way where like the fuel tank was like too out in the open in the back, so any kind of rear impact like that was legitimately blowing them up.
So they got our Roadrunner joke right there.
It's a great escape. It's a Roadrunner. It's a break the fourth wall. Yeah.
Oh, nice. And again, it feels like a real movie.
Yeah, no, it does. Like I was like saying, the rear view is a really cool shot that Steven Spielberg used a lot. So pretty sure he used it in Indiana Jones.
Yeah, well, I mean, it doesn't surprise me because like even though David Zucker and Jim Abrams would do mostly other comedies and parodies films and that, Jerry Zucker was always the more interesting filmmaker because like when he went off solo, he did Ghost and
First
Night, which were more dramatic works as well.
So didn't he go on to do Green Book as well?
Oh, yeah. No, that was Peter.
That was Farley.
Peter.
Farley. Oh, okay. Farley, yeah. Sorry. But comic brothers mixed up. Yeah.
Yeah. But he would come back to comedy with, I guess, so far his last directorial effort, Rat Race. But even then, that was more of a traditional kind of almost. It's a
movie
Mad
I like,
one,
though.
So,
I like Rat Race.
I like it as well, too. Yeah. It has the greatest Barbie joke of all time in it.
It has one of the best Hitler jokes with John Lovitz.
Yes, that's what I was referring to, the Barbie Museum. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. And this sequence is also amazing as well.
Incredible. This is the other sequence I was talking about earlier, about the two sequences in this movie that are just like so classic and memorable. And like, even reading how they had to do this where they could only film like 15 seconds at a time.
And then put some oxygen. Because, you know, they've done it actually underwater. So.
Yeah.
Get the nipple cripple. See, this is what I'm talking about. Like, as much as I love Airplane, this movie has sequences like this in it.
No, it sounds so condescending to call this a proper movie. Like, even Airplane is a proper movie. They're all proper. If you have a camera and you do things, it's a proper movie. But this actually feels like it's trying to it feels like it's trying to actually make a spy movie, a World War II spy movie, but but it's,
well, yeah even in a movie as goofy as this, that moment a couple of minutes ago when the bad guy was driving the truck in, there was this shot of where Nick pulls up next to the truck and he's chewing gum like on the motorcycle and like just giving him like a grin as he pulls up. I was like, damn, that's a movie star, you know? Even in a movie that's silly, you look at that and you go like, this guy's born to be a movie star. We're seeing the birth of a movie star here.
It'll be interesting because, like, he did Real Genius after this and did more of the
I do love Real Genius. I adore Real Genius. Is just a brilliant romance. Is it a romance? No. Him and Tito.
Well, I guess college, like college comedy, I would call it. Yeah.
But it's Martha Coolidge, so it just has that depth of just, and I think he's so good in it. And I think he's actually just really good in this because he is literally playing, playing a movie star in this, which I think the movie needs. Yeah.
Mm. But it's kind of funny, though, like, if this movie was a bigger hit, like, where his career could have gone in a completely different direction, I would say.
Well, yeah, because I remember there's a story that he got offered Top Gun and he didn't want to do it because he thought it was junk. And he was having a conversation with Tom Cruise because he was saying, I kind of want your career or what's sort of happening to you at the moment. And I think Tom Cruise goes, it's not about the project. It's about how you
approach
it and that you can make it your own. And I was listening to this thing, they were talking about Top Gun, and they're saying, because Iceman's right. Everything he says, Maverick is reckless. Maverick doesn't know how to do his job properly. Maverick gets someone killed. Iceman's kind of the one who's, like, correct all the way through the movie. And he kind of plays it like that. He's not the asshole. He's literally just a guy going, look, can you just do your job, like, what you're meant to do? Like, sort of this Maverick bullshit. And I'm just like, oh, yeah, he kind of does too. He kind of is in the right, and then he's still that in Maverick because he's the one that keeps Maverick employed. If it wasn't for Iceman, then he probably would have been kicked out of the Navy like long ago.
And my favorite thing about with Top Gun Maverick, I was like when I was looking it up, it was like, oh yeah, that was the very and Scarecrow's there all of a sudden. It never occurred to me. It's like, oh yeah, Top Gun Maverick was Val Kilmer's very last film and probably the perfect send off for him. But my favorite thing about that whole movie was, like, Tom Cruise was very adamant, like, he would not do that movie unless Val Kilmer was also in it.
Yeah, because he does Top Gun straight up, he does it after Real Genius. So it's, and then does a few kind of weird movies, then it's Willow, where he is like the most charismatic I think he's ever been on screen as in Willow. Like, I love Willow so much. But he's always had a weird career. Like, he'll do weird stuff and then it's like Willow, then it's The Doors. Actually, a movie I don't actually like that much. I should revisit it. But I don't like the movie.
I don't like the movie, but his performance as Morrison is kind of like undeniable.
Okay,
it's like a great performance stuck in a pretty middling movie, I think. Yeah.
I
forgot he's in Backdraft. Sorry, I'm just looking at what he's done.
Yeah. And also, too, like, again, like, with Top Gun, like, even though it's like, this seems like junk, but then he met Tony Scott, got on really well with him, and worked with him two more times after that on True Romance and Deja Vu as well.
It's actually kind of interesting hearing him ever say that he wanted like a Tom Cruise type career, because it always felt to me like he wasn't chasing that. You know, it seemed
I think
like,
at the time when he was young, I think he might have changed afterward, because he definitely didn't have the Tom Cruise career. But I think they obviously knew each other and were probably around the same age coming up. And yeah, because he did not want to do Top Gun. He was like, this movie is stupid. Why would I do this? Tom, why are you doing this? You're better than this. And he was like, no, you can make anything good. And probably Top Gun is probably the best example of that. But no, he's so good. Oh, he's in Flatlanders. I forgot about that.
Also, too, like another missing bit of art form in terms of we don't see in movies these days or in parody films, and I saw a bit of it already, is in the closing credits. We get gags in the closing credits as well.
I was just thinking that, like, we'd be in a, you know, you kids today, before we had post credit scenes, if we stayed behind for credits, it's because it was a parody movie and we wanted to see the joke credits in
To
the.
be fair, no one did them like Zachary and Abrams. Like, I think Mel Brooks would do them a lot, which movie had the recipe for brownies? Was that Robin?
Yeah, I
And
can't remember. I know
it actually had recipe for brownies, and then it actually proceeded to have the recipe for brownies.
I kind of really just need to find
Oh, I love that.
the soundtrack.
The German national anthem based on the school anthem from such and such.
And also, you definitely know when somebody has good taste when Weird Al Yankovic has said that this is his all-time favorite movie.
Oh well, and speak and he made one of the great spoofs with UHF.
Yes.
Take that thing off your face. It's one of my favorite jokes ever.
And also, let's not forget he was in. Actually, he was in all three Naked Gun movies as well in cameos.
And did
Oh,
the
was he?
and
I
did
know,
the
yeah.
he did he also did like the Bond song for Spy Hard. So.
Yes. And of course, actually, I would even say like Weird, the Al Yankovic
Oh, yeah.
story is also a parody film as well. I mean
Yeah, and actually a good one. That's actually one of the good recent, like one of the good modern ones, I'd say.
Yeah, that is actually really good when he's the line, I'm not just going to be an accordion player. I'm going to be the best accordion player in very specific circumstances. Yes, no, it was Abrams who did in Hot Shots in the end credits, there is a recipe for brownies in there. So,
Yes.
yes.
Well, there you go. That was hot. I mean, not Hot Shots. Completely different movie.
Still a
That
good
was
movie,
Top
not as good
Secret.
as the
Yes.
sequel.
Yes. I mean, the sequel has amazing gags in that movie. I'm just saying it right now.
The girl die on the diving board, diving on the bed is still one of my favorite jokes in film.
And also, like the kill counter, it's like this is bloodier than RoboCop. This is the bloodiest movie of all time.
Well, and like I mean, if we're all putting out our favorite Hot Shots Part Two jokes, I mean the Martin Sheen cameo with is
Yes.
just
Yes.
one of the great like movie meta jokes. Yeah,
I loved you, Wall Street.
Wall Street.
But yeah, well, that is our audio commentary of Top Secret. And thank you both, Lindsay and Trev, for joining me for this special episode. Not only just to watch a really hilarious and great film, but also to pay tribute to the late Val Kilmer as well.
It was really fun because I know why we talked about like, is this going to be a tough one to do a commentary for? And I'm glad that we were able to just have like a really good conversation about like what is comedy and what works. But yeah, it also was obviously really special to just go back and see young Val again. And because we were mentioning a bunch of his movies during that, I'll also just throw out the two that didn't get brought up that I would say if anyone is like planning a little mini, Val Kilmer marathon right now, also add in for sure Wonderland, the movie where he played John Holmes, which is kind of
Yes,
like a
that's a really
comeback
good
film
one.
for him at the time. Very, very good. And Salt and Sea, which he's
Oh,
awesome
yeah.
in.
Yeah, that's a. And also, I would have sort of thrown in The Ghost in the Darkness, which was also a personal favorite of mine growing up as well. And it was legit terrifying with man-eating tigers. So there you go.
Lions, lions.
Oh, sorry, lions,
I
I
mean,
meant to say.
I hate to say, you never want to talk about like what are the positives that come out of someone passing, but there's like a part of me that is kind of hoping that now with all the renewed attention on Val Kilmer and people looking back at his filmography, that maybe this will be a little bit of extra impetus to actually get the Joel Schumacher cut of Batman Forever out there.
Yes.
Because I really want to see that. Yeah.
No,
I agree.
Yeah, I mean, the Jim Carrey of it all always has always annoyed me. Well, except when I was a teenager and I was loved everything he did. Always annoyed me a little bit with that movie. Same with Tommy Lee Jones, even though he does not sanction that Jim Carrey's buffoonery. He definitely sanctioned his own, but I think the Nicole Kidman, Val Kilmer parts of that movie is just works so well.
And also too, because you can tell with at least Batman Forever, and I've said this many times, that until Batman Begins, you could tell that they wanted to make this one solely the focus on Bruce Wayne as a character and his how being Batman has, I get what how he sort of feels about himself as Batman on a psychological level, but obviously they cut all that stuff out because, you know, it's quote unquote too
Not
dark. But
toyetic, not toyetic, yeah.
yes, well, that too. And yeah, it'd be great to kind of see like the, I mean, I know people have made fatter versions of that of Batman Forever out there as a longer version, but yeah, if we could get a really cool like proper Schumacher cut of that film, that'd be pretty awesome because we know it's out there, it exists,
It
it
exists.
it does
No.
exist,
As much as my favorite Batman is Batman Returns, that is not a Batman movie. And I realize this, but it just speaks to me that I'm just more interested in the Rogues Gallery.
That's my
But
favorite of those. That's my favorite of that series as well.
yeah, they were not going to make that mistake again. It was going to be McDonald's could sell toys out of it, and this was going to be more fun. But I would love to see a longer cut because I think that's probably what attracted Val Kilmer to it because he's like, well, no, what is it like to be Batman? What does that mean? And we got that later on with the Nolan movies, but it would have been, yeah. Can we just someone do the? I mean, Warner Brothers is the worst at doing this stuff at the moment, but come on, like, let's go.
Can
Catch Up Entertainment buy the Joel Schumacher cut of Batman
And
Forever?
also, can they buy Batgirl as well? So just release it as a curiosity rather than a
Sure. There's also
full-fledged
that,
movie.
like, what there was a the Scoob movie that was finished that they scrapped too. So yeah.
No, I heard that they didn't they sell the Coyote versus Batman
Yeah, to that's what Ketchup
oh,
Entertainment
the
bought it,
ketchup of all the places.
yeah.
I mean, Paramount was bidding for that movie. Want to get okay, anyway, but we're gonna see it.
Well, that's
So
the thing, like Ketchup are probably the best ones because they released the day the world blew up,
which
you know,
is
between
actually
that and
really
Ketchup.
good. I
It
went and
was,
saw
yeah.
that. Yeah, because I was in Hamilton, my hometown, and it was just like, I'm like, I've seen all these movies, or I do not want to see Snow White. And I was like, let's go see when the world ends. I'm like, this is actually really good. Like, this is like Looney Tunes with a little bit of heart to it. And I'm like, did not realize Porky and Daffy's relationship was this close. Like, this is great.
Definitely, definitely. But before we wrap up the show today, Lindsay, where can people find you on the internet this week and also listen to your podcast, Schlock It All?
Well, you can follow Schlock and All on all the pods. The next episode I'm releasing is also going to involve Bede and Marcy talking about some crossroads. Bede knows exactly what that is. And where I proceeded to, he then I found out something controversial about him and proceeded to yell at him for like 5 minutes about Josie and the Pussycats, with Marcy and kind of starting that whole thing. But you can
See,
find, yeah.
yeah, I was going to say, Lindsay, you might have to do a Bede's controversial opinions episode with Josie and the Pussycats and Empire Records because I also have opinions on that movie as
Okay, we're gonna have to do that. I need to investigate this. just like, Empire Records, I kind of understand now, but 16-year-old me is that movie as it's I Will Die on That Hill. But no, you can follow me, Shock and Awe One or Reading Geek, either on Blue Sky, Instagram, or Letterboxd. That's where you can find me.
Awesome. And Trev, where can people find you on the internet this week and also to listen to your podcasts, which include Failure to Franchise?
Yeah, I just want to quickly say I feel like reading between the lines. I'm discovering here that maybe Bede doesn't like Josie and the Pussycats, and it's breaking my heart. If
It is, yeah. No,
it,
I Marcy mentioned it knowing full well I would yell at him, and I did.
yeah,
So
okay.
I expect
Well,
that.
yeah, a conversation for another time, I guess. But
Yes.
yeah, no, you can listen to Failure to Franchise, which is me and my buddy Chris looking at movies that have failed to start franchises, even though they were intended to. We just wrapped up a 4-movie look at Mark Wahlberg failed franchise starters, and then we'll be heading into doing ones all based on fighting video games. So the two
Ooh.
Street Fighter movies, DOA and Tekken, we're going to be
Oh,
taking a look
nice.
at. And then you can also, I also have Days of Future podcast, which is my X-Men podcast. You can check that out as well. And then you can find me on Letterboxd as well under Trevor Snyder and follow along with my movie journey.
Nice. And if people were to find me personally out there on the internet, you can follow me on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Letterboxd under Bede Jermaine. You can find all my work over at supermarcy.com. And also you can listen to my solo show, Bede versus the Living Dead, and its spin-off shows on all podcast streamers everywhere via the Bede versus the Living Dead podcast feed. And in terms of everything at the Super Podcast, you can follow the show on all podcast streamers everywhere. And you can also follow the show on social media, on Twitter, Blue Sky, and Facebook. And you can just find all our reviews and all the shows and all other awesome good stuff over on supermarcy.com. And if you want to support the show, you can find the Super Network on Patreon as well and get awesome exclusive features and perks for only as little as $1 a month. So yeah, that is a wrap for this episode of the Super Podcast. Thanks for joining us, everyone. And we'll see you all next time. And also, farewell, Val Kilmer. We'll miss you. See you, everybody. Bye. She knows just what to do. Got a girl named Sue. She knows just what to do. Look, I'm not the first guy who fell in love with a girl he met in a restaurant who then turned out to be the daughter of a kidnapped scientist, only to lose her to her childhood lover who she'd last seen on a deserted island and who turned out 15 years later to be the leader of the French underground. I know it. It all sounds like some bad movie. Got a girl named Daisy. She almost drives me crazy. Got a girl named Daisy. She almost drives me crazy. She rocked me to the east, she rocked me to the west, but she's the girl that I love best. So tutti frutti, oh Rudy. 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 A wop, bop, a loop, bam, a lop, bam.